Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Marie DeMars. And we have an amazing guest here today.
Brian Herskowitz. Hello.
So I'm going to tell you all about Brian. In a nutshell, we knew each other from judo. We were both competing and nationally, internationally, when we were young. And so we may swap some lies about how good and good looking we used to be. And Brian, you did kind of an amazing thing. I know you're a really modest guy, but I remember you came here from Texas, right? A kid from Texas. I'm going to come to Hollywood and I'm going to make it in the entertainment industry. And 99.9% of those kids, 6 months later, are back in Odessa.
Yep.
And you started out acting, you've been screenwriting, producing, now you're in equity. So you have done all aspects of the entertainment industry and made it.
Everything but catering. I haven't catered yet. No.
I remember you would come to judo practice and you'd say, I can't get any mat burn on my face. Don't anybody touch my face. I got an audition tomorrow.
That's right.
And we all thought it was hilarious.
You have to take care of yourself. You know. I started out in Houston, Texas, where I was from, where I did theater as a kid and always had that love and decided when I was old enough. I went to Japan at 17 to study judo. Came back from Japan after about a year, bopped around a little bit, and then said, I'm going out to Hollywood to make my mark. And I came out and started trying to get work as an actor and did a little bit here and there now and then, did a lot of theater, kept busy. I was on a show called Eight Is Enough. I got to be Willie Ames' drummer in his band when he ran for prom queen. That was one of my big claims to fame. So I had some success, but I wasn't setting the world on fire. But I loved acting and I loved the industry. And as I mentioned, in 1980, I was training for the Olympic trials in judo and blew out my knee. So for I had surgery in 81, and for about 9 months, I was laid up. At that time, in the old days, you know, when you had to walk uphill to school both ways, at that time, they would put you in a non-weight-bearing cast for 9 months. So for 9 months, I couldn't move. I couldn't do judo, I couldn't act, I couldn't do anything. So I was laid up, and I thought, well, I got to do something. And, you know, the creative bug was eating away at me. So I started writing a screenplay. And, of course, what did I write about? I wrote about a kid who went to Japan to study judo. And then I took it to the next level, and that he gets involved with the Yakuza and their American mafia there. And, you know, so it became an action piece. And it was my first attempt at doing a screenplay. I wrote it in 5 days. I thought, well, this is easy. Oh, this is going to be great. And gave it to some people and got an agent, and people were really excited about it. And then I tried to write my second screenplay and went, I have no clue what I am doing. I have no idea how to get here. I wrote myself into a corner and took a lot of time trying to write myself out, and finally literally abandoned the script 70 pages in. And I decided that if I was ever going to have anything other than acting as a fallback, that I wanted to be in the industry. I loved being here in Hollywood. I loved being in the industry. So I wanted to try and learn, what did I miss? What did I screw up on? So I started studying, started reading as many books as I could about screenwriting, started taking classes at different places, different people, Sid Field, John Truby, and slowly but surely came up with my own concepts and precepts for writing, and then actually started working as a writer, mostly in television, then in feature films, and started in almost 30 years ago teaching screenwriting. I started with a company called Writer's Boot Camp, where I taught sitcom writing, because I was a sitcom writer on a couple of shows, old school shows like Blossom and Dream On and shows like that.
Yeah, that TV show that Rhonda's doing, I don't know.
Oh, Battle of the Network Stars?
Oh, I guess we are allowed to say, because now it's been on, like, some of the things, who's on it. But right. One of the guys from Blossom was just on that show.
Joey Lawrence?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Joey's famed claim was, you know, whoa. That was his thing. And I one of my longest conversations with Joey on set was, he came up to me and said, you got good hair. I said, thank you, Joey. And you too. He said, yeah. And that was it. That was our longest conversation. Nice guy, sweet guy, and was known at that time for his hair. Not so much anymore.
I was like, coming from him, that's a compliment, right?
Yeah.
Except for now he's shaved his
hair. That's right. He shaves. He started, I don't know when he started doing that, but at that time he had the long, you know, hair, and it was all about the hair. But so I started teaching sitcom writing that I taught at UCLA Extension for about 10 years. And for the last 10 years, I've been teaching at Boston University in Los Angeles. And during that time, I took all knowledge I had gathered from teaching and from writing and wrote a textbook called Process to Product. And to me, Process to Product, strangely enough, is a philosophy that goes across a lot of different media. Because one of the things I saw, and this was, I actually learned this as a competitor as well, when I was competing and the stakes were high, something, you know, a really important competition, if I was thinking about the outcome, I would choke. So if I was thinking about, you know, oh gosh, I really want to win, there was a little demon on my shoulder going, you're going to lose, you know, and if you lose, what's going to, so you become stiff. And the same thing happens for a writer, for an actor, for a producer, where, you know, you're thinking about the audience and are they going to like it? Are they going to love it? Rather than what's this moment about? How good are these people? What are they looking for? How much can I push the envelope here? What is the story? What is the message I'm trying to get across? So if you're thinking about, oh, this may offend people or this may not work for someone or are they going to laugh here? You know, you can't really put your energy there. You have to put your energy into the process. So the book that I wrote was hopefully a way of taking people through the process of, from the very germ of an idea through to a finished script. And in a process, in a way where they're not thinking about the outcome, but they're thinking about, you know, how do I get there? And a big part of this for me came from, strangely enough, a book on sports psychology that I read that talked about these elite athletes who, you know, when they're getting ready to do a high jump, they don't think about, you know, how high am I going to jump or am I going to clear the bar? They're thinking about, I'm going to take three steps here. I'm going to push off my right foot. I'm going to extend my left leg. I'm going to arch my back. They're thinking about the technique, the specifics. And that's where I think a lot of people trip in an artistic endeavor. And then eventually you want that technique to vanish.
See, that's funny because when I was competing, I never thought about that at all. I mean, I did it until it was automatic.
Right.
And I didn't think about anything when I was fighting. But I was thinking as I'm listening to you about our games, because when I make games, my big thing isn't thinking, oh, well, how many will we sell or how much will people like this? Right. I try to keep in mind, and a textbook author told me this, that kid who's sitting in the classroom and put myself in that place and try to imagine myself being that 12 or 13 or 11-year-old kid who's sitting in math class and doesn't get it, or sitting in math class and doesn't really want to be doing this, or in Spanish class, their teacher said, do this, you know, listen to this game, play this game, it might help your Spanish. Or so I try to and think of all the different types of kids and think about, what would make them interested? What would hold their attention?
Yeah. And that month? So they're done. Yeah.
Textbook author told me this. That kid who's sitting in the classroom and put myself in that place and try to imagine myself being that 12 or 13 or 11-year-old kid who's sitting in math class and doesn't get it.
Right.
Or sitting in math class and doesn't really want to be doing this. Or in Spanish class, their teacher said, do this, you know, listen to this game, play this game, it might help your Spanish. Or so I try to and think of all the different types of kids and think about what would make them interested, what would hold their attention.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's kind of analogous to when you're talking about character in a story and you're talking about how do I develop a character. The Russian acting guru Stanislavski had a thing called the magic if. And the magic if was, if I were that person, how would I behave? What would I do? So kind of transporting yourselves into the skin of someone else who is across the table from you, or imagining. And in fact, Stephen King on writing talked about when he writes something, he astrally projects the image into the future and somebody on the other end receives it. And so that's one of the images that I like to have, is that I'm creating something that somewhere down the line, somebody has to get, receive, and it's the same picture I sent. And if it's not the same picture I sent, I've done something wrong. So that's where I come from on that.
So when you produce things, do you go in and watch people watch your films?
I have. I have done that. Yeah. And sometimes that's a real pleasure, and sometimes it's a real stake through the heart. So it really varies on how well we, you know, we put things out. The thing about, you know, the film industry, there are those pursuits that you do that are singular. You know, I'm an actor, I'm a writer, I'm a producer. But when you go to make a project, it's a collaboration. And it takes, to quote Hillary, it takes a village. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've seen great scripts go bad. But you can't see, you know, you have to have a great script in order to do a great project. But you can do a really bad project even with a great script. So it does take very many people to screw it up. So it's very hard to really succeed. So, you know, the people that are successful with their material, hats off to them, because it's not an easy task.
Is it a different experience watching something or being in the room when people are watching it where you've acted versus that you've written versus that you've produced?
You know, when you're acting, it's so much more personal. You know, I take it so much more personally because they're judging your looks, the way you act, the way you behave, whether or not you succeeded as the character. It's a little less personal because it is that collaboration and they're looking at the direction, the producing, the lighting, the sound, the acting when they're judging the work as a whole. And, you know, you still take it, I tend to take it more personally when it's positive and go, yes, that's right. You know, great. Yeah, that's me. I did that. You know, so when they start to poo-poo the stuff, then I'm going, well, that's somebody else. That was the director.
It was bad lighting.
It was great. And then the director messed it up. It wasn't my fault. So I kind of stick to that as much as possible.
I have a question for you, too, because one of the things we talk a lot about is taking jumps, you know, going to that next step. Uh-huh. So you're a kid coming from Texas. You say, I'm going to go to L.A. and I'm going to make it. One, what did people around you say at the time? And when did they sort of say, oh, maybe he was onto something?
Out here, it's kind of expected. You know, when you go to a restaurant here, you expect the waiter, you know, to be an actor. You do. You don't expect them to be able. And, you know, so there's a part of you that I certainly had people who, you know, I'd say I'm an actor and they go, yeah, yeah, sure. You know who Steven Seagal is, right? Okay, yeah. Very well. Well, when I was producing a TV series, I was looking for a place to train that was kind of close to my house, and I noticed there was an Aikido dojo 5 minutes from my home on La Cienega in Santa Monica, and I thought, I'm going to go train. So I called up the dojo, and I said, hey, I do judo. I was wondering if maybe I could come by, and maybe I could teach judo in exchange for Aikido classes and train at your dojo. And this guy says, yeah, well, come on by. And I go and I walk into this dojo and there's this guy sitting on the couch and he stands up and he's about, you know, 3.5 inches around and about 6'5". I mean, he's just this beanpole. He stands up and up and up. I watch him do Aikido. His Aikido is flawless. And I'm going, who is this guy? How come I didn't know about this? And his Japanese is exquisite. And I'm thinking, he speaks Japanese and really good at Aikido. And he comes over and he starts talking. And he says, what do you do? And I said, well, I write and produce television. I was at the time doing a series called Tour of Duty, which is about the Vietnam War. And he says, I'm not an actor or writer, but I just got a 3-picture deal with Warner Brothers with my name above the title. And I went, yeah, sure you did. I thought he was just yanking my chain. I thought there's no way in hell that this guy is anybody. And the next time I saw him, I was waiting to, I had to show him that I could do judo. So I brought a friend over to train with me. And we're waiting at the dojo, and he drives up in a Rolls Royce. And I went, and I think you and I probably have similar experiences. I'd never met anybody that didn't have like a 69 Pinto at top martial arts in judo. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I mean, Chuck Norris, yeah, you know, karate guys.
Judo's not a high dollar occupation.
Judo guys, you know, they had to have 12 jobs, and maybe then, you know, they had a bicycle. You know, so I went, who is this guy who's driving a Rolls Royce? And then I found out that he was married to a woman named Kelly LeBrock, who had been this beautiful actress in The Woman in Red and Weird Science. And then I found out that one of his students was the largest, most famous agent in Hollywood, a guy named Mike Ovitz. And Mike had said to him, he had told him some of his stories about his experiences, and he said, I can make you a star, kid. And sure enough, he did have a 3-picture deal with his name above the title, and the first one was Above the Law, and it came out about 2 months later. And I ended up not really teaching any judo there. The guy who I brought in did. But I was blown away by that. I think there's often that skepticism, where you meet people and they say, you know, I'm going to be a big star, and you go, yeah, you poor thing, sure you are. Good luck with that. And yet, once in a while, it happens just like that, and it's a little bit like a shark attack. You kind of hear about it, and you know, everybody knows that there was a shark attack because it's so rare, but it does happen.
Whether you're doing a startup like we are, or mm-hmm. going into Hollywood or competing, you know, on the international level, there's a certain amount of risk taking that has to go on.
Absolutely.
I mean, like you and I, when we were young, I'm going to be the best judo player in the world. I'm going to travel around the world. I'm going to go to Japan, live there. And that's pretty insane. I mean, mm-hmm. we both did that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got some family connections. You could have gone back to Texas, got a nice job. Like, is your brother an accountant now?
My brother is an attorney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he was going to be an accountant.
He was an accountant first.
Oh. So, you know, you could have gone that route and had a very comfortable living.
No, well, I could not. Nope. Not going to happen. No.
It is theoretically possible.
No, not even theoretically. No, that was never going to happen. I could have done something else. I thought about physical therapy at one point. That was, after getting so beaten up and having the injuries, I thought about that. Too much work. It's too much work. It's too much mental work. I just couldn't do it. I'm in the midst of putting together a startup as well. I'm with a company called the Horror Equity Fund, and we're a company that identifies, helps to fund and accelerate to market projects in the horror world of horror entertainment. So horror films, games, entertainment across the board. So you have to be at a place where you're willing to take risks, and you have to be gutsy. You have to be able to walk up to someone and say, I've got a company, we're going to make millions of dollars. You have to have a certain amount of chutzpah, to use the Japanese word. And it's, you have to be able to say that, this is what we do, and this is why we're better than everybody else. And you have to believe it. And I think a lot of people tend to fail as they don't believe their own hype. And I think you have to be realistic about things. I think you have to have at least some awareness of where you fit in the world. But if you're not confident in yourself, it's more difficult to succeed.
Yeah, that kind of just turned on a light bulb for me, because we've gone through some salespeople in our company. And for me, it's not difficult, because I pick up the phone and I say, hey, we have these amazing games that would be really great for your kids. And they've been shown to improve math scores 3 times as much as, just the regular math class. Right. And would you like me to come out and show you these games? Would you like us to get on Skype? And you're right. I think you have to really believe that what you're doing is important and better than everybody else out there, or at least better than what they've got. And you have to, whether it's doing a startup or going into the entertainment industry or being at the top of your sport, being on the extreme success of anything, you need that kind of schizophrenic combination of believing that you can do it better than other people, whatever the other is, and also enough humility to constantly be trying to get better and constantly trying to learn.
And I think, again, that comes from this idea of kind of self-awareness, knowing exactly where your strengths and your weaknesses are. And I think that's true in any endeavor, and playing to your strengths and helping to improve your weaknesses.
We'll be right back.
Irma the intern here. I grew up in a household where my parents are bilingual, but to be honest, my Spanish isn't as good as I'd like. That's why I love Aztec Games, because it's helping me improve my Spanish as well as brush up on math and history. And that's why I'm backing it on Kickstarter. You should too! Just go to 7generationgames.com/Kickstarter today. For as little as $1, $1, you can get Aztec Games and get better at Spanish or math or history or gaming. Aztec Games on Kickstarter. Back it today.
And we're back with more Than Ordinary, presented by 7 Generation Games. I, of course, am still Maria Burns Ortiz.
And I'm still Anne Maria DeMars. And we still have with us our amazing guest,
Brian Herskowitz. Still here.
So I want to talk about 2 more things before we get to the tip. So the first one is, you said it would be all right if I brought this up. I have not seen your family on TMZ.
Thank God.
You married a woman who was extremely well known. She was on Mork and Mindy, which when we were young was like the biggest show on television.
Yep.
And you guys got married when we were back competing way back when, and you're still married.
Yep.
And from everything I've seen, she likes you, and you have kids, and they're normal kids, and they are smart. How did you do that in Hollywood?
Well, let me start by saying we had to make sure that everything was going to work okay, so we dated for 9 years. Before we got married. So I want to make sure that it was, that we weren't, making any sudden moves.
You didn't want to rush into anything.
Did not want to rush into
anything. You made it through the probationary period.
Exactly.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. So we dated for 9 years, and then we got married in 1988, and we've been married, whatever the math is on that. Let's see, 29,
almost
right?
Yeah.
I need your daughter's help. But part of it is we like each other, we get along well, we give and take, and we've learned to fight fair. And what I mean by that is when we have disagreements and arguments, it doesn't get ugly. It doesn't get to a place where one of us goes in a room and locks the door and hides. We discuss it, we talk about it, we figure out, and we try not to get down to the personal attacks, but about what's the issue? What are we looking at? What's the problem? So we negotiate that very well. In terms of the parenting side of it, one of the things that we had kind of an interesting start with parenting, because my wife had been an actress for many years, and as you said, was on Mork and Mindy. But prior to that, she had been a babysitter, loved kids, always wanted to have kids, and thought at that time that she knew everything there was to know about kids. And one of the things we discovered And this has been my mantra, and I think one of the reasons that we've been successful is I realized and have discovered that I know nothing, and that as a parent, all parents know nothing. Because until you're there, no matter what people tell you, no matter how many times they say, well, you know, this is going to happen, this is going to be difficult, or you're going to have trouble with this, you go, yeah, no, I know. And when she was about ready to give birth to our first child, every 2 or 3 days, someone would say to us, so, you know, who's coming in to help you out with the child when she's born? And we'd say, nobody. And they'd give this kind of blank stare, like, are you out of your mind? And they said, well, you have family here? Say, no, no family. And say, and finally, about 3 days before the due date, we went out to dinner, and I turned to her, my wife, and I said, you know, people keep saying maybe we should have somebody here to help us out, like a nurse or a nanny or a relative. And she says, oh, no, forget it. You know, look, I got two boobs. You know, the kid's going to drink. You'll be able to go play computer games or write or whatever you want to do. Not a problem. It's, you know, this is going to be easy breezy. And I said, okay. I said, just in case that things don't go exactly the way that we're thinking they're going to go, would you be willing to consider having something? She said, yes, but it's not going to happen. Well, everything that could go wrong went wrong. Child was jaundiced when she was born. She was under Billy lights for a week. We had to feed her with a syringe every 45 minutes. My wife was having difficulty getting milk, so she was breast pumping every hour, literally 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the first 6 weeks. We didn't sleep at all. And at one point, she turned to me and said, I'm not sure I like this child. And I'm like, it's okay. This is okay. And then finally, we got somebody to help us out. When I say I know nothing, I'm being pretty serious. You don't know the experience until you're in it. And two things that I did that I kind of pat myself on the back on, and not that I did it well, but I took a parenting class and I read books about it. And I knew enough to go, okay, this is what people are telling me. This is what the books are saying. This is what the parenting advice is. And I have to be flexible enough to forgive myself when I make a mistake. And those were all the things that I kind of put together and my wife put together. And then we also had a great balance in terms of, you know, how we dealt with the questions that would come up. And I had a 50-50 shot of getting things wrong, and I knew that. So generally, I always, you know, I'd say, can I have this candy? Ask your mother. You know, that was always my response. And if the mother said, because sure enough, if I said, no, you can't, then she would go to her mom and she'd say, well, sure, she can have that candy, and say, okay. Or if I did the opposite, she'd say, what are you giving her sugar for? So I always went, okay, you get her answer first, and then I will either support or I'll try and, you know, defend you on that.
And the thing that I found out, I have three, is you think you kind of have it down after the first one, like, hey, I've gone through this, I know what's going on. And then you have a second one, and they prove you completely wrong on everything.
Yeah, because it's not the same experience. It's never the same experience. A different child, different experience. And even though there's that genetic code and predisposition to have similarities, I think children kind of automatically, they're like goo, and they'll find the crevices and the cracks that aren't already taken. So, you know, you've got the one kid that's the outgoing kid, that's the funny kid, then the other one wants to be the serious, you know, introspective kid. And if you have one that's the talent here, you have one that's the talent there. You have one that's physical, you have one that's not.
It's true. Psychologists say that everyone's behaviorist until they have their second child.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And yet they're part of you and your parenting and their environment and everything else. So you just try and support and a little bit go with the flow. And my thing as a parent was always give them as much freedom within the boundaries that I set. So try and set boundaries that say you can go up to this wall, you can go up to this wall, you can go up to this wall. Whatever you do inside that box is yours. And I'm going to try and keep you in that box. And sometimes they kind of break free and you kind of bring them back in, and sometimes they don't.
Do you think it's harder raising kids, especially in the entertainment industry today, because of social media, because of all this attention, or not?
I think in general, there are a lot more risks to kids because information is free-flowing in a way that there are no restrictions on it. And so there's information that is both harmful and bogus. And so the kids can look up stuff and it's just not true, and they can believe it. And conversely, there's stuff that is true that can scare the crap out of them. But I don't know that it's any different from industry to industry to industry. You know, one of the things about being in the entertainment industry is I had a lot of downtime where I was just with my kids. My office was most of the time in my home. Not always, because I was working on a show, I'd be on a show, and I did that quite a bit. But when you're not actively on a show or on a movie, you're at home, and you're home to be there for your child. So there was a lot more freedom that way as well. And I think that's one of the things that people struggle with is how do you balance, I have to make a living, I have to have some time for myself, and I have to take care of my kids. And I think a lot of people, when things suffer, sometimes it's the kids.
Well, I think that's kind of similar with having a startup. There's a lot of time and there's a lot of travel and you're gone a lot and all these things. But then I do think, you know, when I'm home, okay, well, you know what? I can take the day off and I can go to the spelling bee for the morning, or we'll leave work early on Wednesday and go to Disneyland for the afternoon, because you do have that flexibility that you don't necessarily have if you're working that corporate 9 to 5, you have to be here at this time. There's a lot more hours and chaos that goes into it when you're self-employed or running a startup or working on a set or whatever it is. But there is that flexibility that I think makes it better sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you mentioned about the internet and about technology and how it's changed. And one of the things that's changed is the way people do business. When I was younger, you had a job, and even in a startup, you had a job. It was basically 9 to 5. You didn't have access to people around the world 24/7. When I worked on Tour of Duty, I had a pager. Probably 90% of your audience doesn't know what a pager is.
Did you ever accidentally drop it in the toilet?
I wish I had, believe me, a few times. I don't think I ever dropped it in the toilet. But I was one of those things you would go off while I was driving and scare the heck out of me. I'm shocked I never had a pylon on the freeway. But the truth is now you have more flexibility, but you're also working longer. I find myself 11, 12 o'clock at night sending emails and answering emails to people around the world that are reaching out to me so that it doesn't pile up. And I still have 10,000 emails, you know, coming in my inbox. So
people used to talk about being on a plane, being downtime. You can read a book, you can catch up. Now with Wi-Fi, you're just working the entire time as well.
You can't use that excuse anymore. You can't reach me. I'm unreachable.
Well, I am really bad about that, Maria. I'm always gone. And when I started my first company, the kids were all little, and there, you know, my husband had passed away. I really had no choice. I was flying somewhere all of the time. Mm-hmm. But when, and Julia got a scholarship to boarding school, to Villanova Prep, and she went there. And one reason it was kind of feasible for us is I, at that point, I just said, all right, weekends, I'm going to be home. Mm-hmm. And so I could work 90 hours from Monday through Friday when she was at school and be in Wisconsin or Wyoming or wherever. But then come Friday night, she came home from school, we were home for the weekend. So I think whatever your career is, you just have to make that time for your kids.
Yep.
I'm really bad at that. And I was at Rhonda's house with all these kids from the Gompers Judo program when we were coming back from Las Vegas. And she said, everybody leave their phone in the car. And there was 9 teenagers and then a couple of little kids. And she said, whatever it is that you have to post on Instagram or that, you could socialize. And they did. They got on a four-wheeler and rolled around and had Nerf gun wars and did all this stuff. And of course, me, I've got my phone and I've got to text things and I've got to do this. And she says, you know, Mom, probably you could spend time with friends and family for an hour and it wouldn't determine whether you got that next grant or next investment. And she was right. We had a really good time. But that's my 1 hour for the month. So there, I'm done.
Yeah, the technology and the ability to reach out to people no matter where they are in the world, no matter when it is, constantly has changed the paradigm for how free time is spent and what that means to people. And the ability to kind of shut down, literally shut down everything, fewer and fewer people are able to do it. And I think it's become actually kind of a national addiction, this idea of, you know, you've got to be able to get to your phone. And I'm guilty of it. I'm certainly guilty of it. But I observe it. I went to, was it Disneyland or Universal Studios with a group of kids and parents. And I have a photograph of 8 kids lined up against the wall, all looking at their phones. They're in the middle of this Harry Potter world and wizards flying by. And all of them are staring at these 3.5-inch by 5 phones.
I'm looking forward, though, to the ability to track my daughters when they're teenagers.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere on the map, like the Marauders map in Harry Potter.
Exactly.
It'll show me where they are.
You know, they're chipping kids now. That's the next thing. It's like you're your pet. That's coming.
Yes, Julia didn't notice when she was in high school and she got her driver's license and a car that we had the tile on her keys so she could find it. But then we also always knew who she was.
Yeah.
Now she's in college. Too late, Julia.
Oops. Oopsie.
She was a good kid. She's still a good kid.
We'll be right back after this.
Hey there, it's Maria, your more than ordinary co-host and CEO of 7 Generation Games, asking you to please back our Kickstarter for Aztec Games. Now, through September 5th, you can help us reach our goal and get Aztec games out faster and further. Give a dollar and get our first two games in the Aztec series. For $25, you can get your name in the credits. That makes you, like, a tiny bit internet famous, and you'll be supporting a whole classroom to get the games. With rewards from a dollar and up, you can get cool stuff, not to mention our undying appreciation. You could even score yourself a spot right here on this very podcast. Just go to 7generationgames.com/Kickstarter. And we're back with everyone's favorite More Than Ordinary segment, More Than Ordinary presented by 7 Generation Games, that is, the tip part of our podcast, where we ask our guest to give us a tip. And the tip can be anything. It can be dating related. It can be work related. It can be things you wish you knew. It could be things you wish other people knew. Basically, it is up to you.
Ah, okay. Boy, that's a lot of pressure. Let me see if I can think of it.
But you're up to it.
I am up to it. My biggest tip is to find your bliss and follow it. Whatever your passion is, understand it and understand how it serves you and the world. And then take that and follow that path. That's my tip for the day.
Sometimes people say that, but then the response is, well, what if I have no money? What if I'm broke and working a minimum wage job and getting my meals from 7-Eleven? Bad idea, the 7-Eleven meals, but whatever. But, you know, it's easy for you to say because you are at that level of success. Your father was kind of a big-time writer.
Nobody starts at that level of success. And when I, you know, when I came out here, my parents weren't supporting me. I came out here on my own. They didn't abandon me. I won't put it that way. But they weren't. I had to make my own way. And I actually studied with an acting teacher who was a very well-known, a guy named Milton Katselas, who passed away about 7 or 8 years ago. But he was an Academy Award nominated director and this incredible acting coach. And one of the things he used to say over and over again is, you know, people would complain about, you know, I don't have any money and I can't. And he'd say, it's not an excuse. You find a way. And it would be, I can't afford acting class. Well, yeah, you can. Go to the class and say, I'll sweep. I'll take out the garbage. I'll work, you know, as your assistant. Do those things. Do whatever it takes if you really believe that this is what you want to do. So part of it has to do, again, with this idea of being true to yourself and knowing in your heart what you're confident in doing. So the idea that I don't have money, nobody starts, I mean, other than people who shall remain nameless, born with a silver spoon, you know, nobody is born with money. In terms of following their bliss, and even if they are, that doesn't necessarily lead them down the path they want to go. So finding that path is different from I can't afford that path. And even if it's to the one thing you see over and over again, actors, writers, people want to be directors, they're taking what we call the toy job. I'm going to work as an Uber driver. I'm going to work as a barista. I'm going to work at, a friend of mine was in this acting class, a guy named Patrick Swayze. You know, Patrick was on, you know, Roadhouse and unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago as well. But, you know, he had worked a little bit as an actor, but when he was in class, he was doing construction. He was building homes and he was broke. And we would make sandwiches for him and, you know, the class would bring him food. And then he hit big and he became a big star. It happens that way too. But he didn't let the fact that he was starving stop him from pursuing his dream. And I see that over and over again. And it's the people, and you talked about early in our conversation, you were talking about the people that came out to LA and they were here for a little bit and failed and went back. And one of the keys to success is I don't give up. I stick to it. And I don't mean me personally, I mean one who is succeeding. And it's those people that say, I will not be denied. This is what I want to do, and this is how I'm going to go after it. And have a plan, for goodness sake. Don't just sit by the phone going, okay, call me, I'm going to be a star. Have a plan. Know how you're going to get there. Do what you have to do to improve your craft in whatever you want to do and whatever your desire is, whether it's an artist, whether it's an actor, whether it's a businessman. Those are all skills that can be learned and improved upon. So you have a plan. Think about how to get there. And if the plan doesn't work, change the plan. Don't give up. And if you do that, eventually you'll find a groove and you'll find your bliss.
Well, and one thing I really like that you said, you talk about finding your bliss. And sometimes you hear people talk about it, they say, well, if you do what you love, if you're chasing what you love, it's never work. But the reality is, it really is work. Like, I really like what we do. But a lot of times what I'm doing is work. And I'm not sitting there going, oh my gosh, I love every second of this. There's no work involved. And I think a lot of times people confuse chasing your passion without having to have it feel like work. And what you talked about is such an important part of that, because even if you're doing what you really love, to be really good at anything, you're working pretty hard.
I've taught, like I said, I've taught screenwriting for 30 years. And over that 30 years, you run into one out of 100 that have real talent and craft. But the truth of the matter is, hard work beats talent. And, you know, the people that work hard can succeed, where the people who are talented and don't work fail. So it's important that if you love something, doesn't mean that it is automatic.
I think the other point that people often don't realize coming into something, well, in a startup is a prime example, or a sport, how long it takes. Because there's a lot of people I see that, oh, I can do it. And again, whether it's a startup or whether it's trying to be an Olympic champion, they can come in and they can work really hard for a while. And they go, oh, I could do this. And they look at the work you're doing. And if you're getting up, say you're working on a screenplay, I don't know anything about screenwriting, so you and Maria can laugh at me, but say that you're working on it for hours and hours on end, and then you get it done, and then you have to edit it. I know, like when I write grants, it's like that.
Yeah.
And people look at that and they say, oh, well, you know, I could do that. But they don't realize that, yeah, I wrote that grant. And then the next week, I had to write another one. And then I had to fly to Wyoming and meet with a bunch of people and talk to them. And then I had to fly to North Dakota and meet with a bunch of people and talk to them. And then I had to write, you know, I had to write up all the analyses for this game. And so I think what people aren't used to is how really long you have to keep at that work.
Yeah, there certainly are the anecdotal overnight successes. The person that was discovered and suddenly became a big star, that one person that wrote a screenplay and suddenly they're fabulously wealthy. But the norm is that you're an overnight success after 20 years of struggling. And the people that become infamous and famous do so after incredible hard work. You know, sometimes it happens quickly, you know, but strangely enough, when it does happen quickly, oftentimes those people burn brightly and burn out because they're not prepared for the success, and they're not prepared because they didn't train for it, and it's training. So there you have it.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks so much for joining us, and to everybody listening, is there a website or anything they can go for more information?
I would love you to try and take a look at my company website, which is www.horrorequityfund.com. And I also have a personal website that I don't keep up with, but it's brianherskowitz.com. I think that one's pretty easy.
But Brian with an I.
Brian with an I. And Herskowitz is H-E-R-S-K-O-W-I-T-Z. But the Horror Equity Fund is a new company. It's kind of exciting. I'd love for you to check it out.
So if we do a game that has like stabbing people in it, we could come to get funding from you?
Absolutely. We'll definitely do something like that.
Yeah, because you certainly won't be getting funding from schools.
Right? Dennis is anti-stab. And we're 7 Generation Games. Buy our games. Like us on iTunes. Like us on Facebook. Come to our office. No, don't come to our office.
unless you're bringing large bags of money.
In which case, 4th and Wilshire, Santa Monica.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7generationgames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7generationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.